Welcome to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. I'm Kelly Aramaris. John Judge was born in Washington, D.C., part of the post-World War II baby boom. He grew up in the shadow of the Pentagon, the CIA, and the NSA. His parents were career civilian employees of the Pentagon. An outspoken critic of the militarization of society, Judge is also an independent researcher, author, lecturer, and political activist. He is the former executive director of COPA, the Coalition on Political Assassinations. His work has helped secure release of 4.5 million pages of records related to the JFK assassination, and he continues working for a full release of the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination records. On September 19, 2002, Judge gave a talk in Oakland, California called 9/11 and New Wars. Here are excerpts of that lecture.
In 96, the talk was titled, Are You Scared Yet? And the subtitle was Terrorism, Phony Terrorism, Counterterrorism, and the Strategy of Tension. And what I talked about were government plans that have been going on for 20 years to replace the threat of communism with the alleged threat of terrorism and to create a rise in domestic terrorism that would lead to the end of civil liberties and a march toward martial law. And also a march toward increased war. It's not something that I wish I had been predictive about, but the reality is that the underpinnings of all this exist back to then. And so I would rather not have seen, as many of us, I'm sure, the morning of September the 11th and what's ensued since in terms of the society that we're now being forced to live in. And I'm certainly reminded of George Orwell's three slogans on the building of the Ministry of Truth in the year 1984. He was really writing about 1948, and that was the original title of his book. But the slogans are, war is peace, ignorance is strength, and freedom is slavery. If you don't hear those reverberating somewhere in the current period, I think you need to take your earplugs out. On September the 11th last year, the United States entered the world community. And we were no longer exempt from the plague of horrors that have abounded in modern history in countries all over the world, and which, unfortunately, these horrors are ones in which the United States has been directly or indirectly responsible during the last 50 years. But it's 50 years of both covert and overt wars and coups d'etats, assassinations, and international commerce in guns and drugs, military and other types of political intervention, corporatization, structural adjustment under the World Banks and the current corporate and neoliberal model, and a long history of ecocide, ethnocide, and genocide that began in earnest with the Vietnam War, but was really a legacy of the end of World War II and the developments there under the rise of fascism. Does that mean, because the United States was involved in those things, that innocent people should have died on September 11th? Well, of course not. That was a crime against humanity and a mass murder as well. But the problem is that for most Americans, we do not know what has been done in our name in the rest of the world. For many Americans, we don't understand, as was asked after September 11th, why do they hate us in other countries? The version of reality we are given is that we are a nation of generous people who provide foreign aid abroad and help countries to go toward democracy. And while in the hearts of many people in this country, that may be their intent and it may be what they'd like to do or feel that they're doing, the deeper reality is different. And people see a different face of America in most of the relations in the world. And even the foreign aid that we brag about being so large and sometimes complain about not being used here for certain communities is about 70 to 75% military assistance and weapons. The problem is, I think, that these things have been done without our knowledge, and that's happened because our history, with the inception of the national security state in 1948, has become a commodity of that state. Our history has been stolen from us, especially in the current period. It's always probably been distorted, but it became actively impossible to access after the development of the classification systems. There's one archive in Washington, D.C., not far from my house in Suitland, Maryland, that is merely the military archive of the National Records Administration. And this military archive is the classified military documents since the end of World War II. And they exist in Suitland in underground buildings. Each of the buildings is an acre in size. There are 27-acre-sized buildings holding merely the classified documents since the end of World War II relating to military operations. So we literally have to dig our history up now from its being buried. And when a people don't own or control their history, when they can't have access to history, that's a mark of a conquered people. And without access to that history, we live in a world where, as Martin Schatz quite presciently says, the political paralysis in America is that we are allowed to believe anything but to know nothing. Although, I don't know if you saw the front page of the Chronicle today, but here's evidence of a Senate committee getting documents that date back to 95, 96, 98, 2000, and 2001 about information that the different intelligence agencies knew in advance that planes were going to be targeted at buildings in the United States, including the Twin Towers, from the Al-Qaeda and these groups. So, no, I don't have those documents, but the secret committees of Congress have seen them. But for me, the question is not whether we could have or did have foreknowledge, because I don't think that essentially leads us to where we have to go with this, and it may lead us in the wrong direction. For the Senate Intelligence Committee to say, we had this foreknowledge, but we didn't use it, it means that we had an intelligence failure on September 11th, and therefore, how do we fix it? Well, we need to increase the budget of the intelligence agencies. We need to strengthen the intelligence agencies' coordination with each other. We may need to put them all under one particular roof. I mean, there's many solutions to this kind of a problem, but it's not a solution that does any of us any good. You know, there will be smoking guns to come, but if your goal in Nazi Germany was to document the Holocaust before you could do something about it, I'd suggest you might have ended up dead. Okay? I mean, we can't fully document because we don't own this history, and our reality, therefore, is also a commodity of this secrecy and this security state. And Eisenhower, in his departing speech when he left office, in the original speech, and I've seen the copy of what he actually wrote, warned about the rise of a, quotes, military-industrial intelligence complex. That third word was dropped out then in the final speech. Even he could see what was coming, and we passed over then on September 11th, in many ways like November 22nd, 63, a paradigm shift with different sets of assumptions and different messages being given to us about the world we lived in and the kind of power that we had. Security is now posed as the source of liberty, which I would suggest is upside down. Liberty is the source of security. And we have this situation where we're going into, again, a permanent war economy. We're increasing the DOD and the CIA and the DIA budgets. And most people have heard of the CIA, but they haven't heard of the DIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency. But do you know that the DIA has a budget 100 times the CIA and the FBI combined? Do you know that it has 10 times as many personnel as the CIA and the FBI combined? You know that the Office of Naval Intelligence under the DIA is the oldest and largest intelligence agency in the United States? Do you know that the most secret police force and the largest police force, government police force in the United States, is the Defense Industrial Security Command under the DIA? Have you ever heard of an organization with the initials NRO? Those initials themselves used to be secret. It's out now, the National Reconnaissance Office, they run the satellites. The NSA, National Security Agency, which tracks every electronic communication in the world, these are all under DIA. The CIA can come up with a plan for an assassination, a coup, or some sort of thing abroad, but they have to go to the Pentagon and liaison with the DIA to actually carry out the plan because the CIA doesn't have any planes or weapons or troops or people to move around on its own. They can subcontract some people, but they really exist in relation to military intelligence. The real inception of the national security state dating back to World War I is a history of military intelligence spying. Army intelligence files spying on radicals led to the Palmer raids, and those files were given to J. Edgar Hoover, which became the basis later of COINTELPRO and the attacks on civil liberties here in the United States came out of Army intelligence. Army intelligence was spying on Dr. King's grandfather, and they were spying on Dr. King himself. Okay, but we rarely hear of military intelligence or the role that it plays or have a way to take much of a look at it. And certainly this budget of trillions and trillions of dollars since the end of World War II has created a machinery of death that makes the old Nazi Hohenzollern Wehrmacht look like a rubber band affair in terms of its genocidal capability. Most people have been taken down a path since those years of seeing fascism an enemy, and then communism replacing that, and now terrorism replacing communism. But isn't it the case that those enemies, in terms of their actual threats, diminish, while at the same time what we're supposed to be financing in terms of a response to the increases, so that we need a bigger budget to deal with six terrorist groups than we did with a whole continent that had nuclear arms. Of course, all of this is based on government lies and staged incidents that are used to create wars. There's nothing unusual about staging incidents to create wars. If you go back in the real history, the Maine, the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, Tonkin Gulf, over time it came out that these incidents were either prompted or staged or known about in advance, let to happen or created to happen in order to get the propaganda necessary to bring the United States into war. Fascism is not some little guy with a mustache who hates Jews. Fascism is a final stage in the monopoly concentration of power and control and money within capitalism. It's a stage that has to do with a devaluation of the currency. It has to do with economic collapse. At the same time, it had a tremendous concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, and with a technological leap forward that makes labor expendable. And then, depending on the biases of that particular society, it's going to see those people as useless eaters, as people that are taking up space. And so we're very much at that point, although it's not the only way that we can relate to that. We're living in a time where I believe the extension of the fascist agenda and the dreams of those fascists, when you have these preconditions, along with commoditization of everything, everything is marketable. All human interactions, relations, intimacies are taken into and stolen from us and then sold back to us in their most distorted form. So sexual intimacy becomes pornography within that model. And everything is commoditized, so that's why before they take them to the gas chambers, they clip the hair of the Jews, or they take the gold out of their teeth, or they melt down their fat and make it usable, because everything is a commodity. And every commonwealth is then privatized. And that's the current agenda. And I have a good book, if you haven't seen it, called Silent Theft, about all the methods that have to do with privatization of what's left with the commonwealth. But the commonwealth, which used to be lands that people lived on and held as commons, began to erode as far back as the 13th century, when the lords were given the right by kings to rope off as much land as they could, send thugs out to protect, and then to charge rents and to deed the land to them. And there's an old English nursery rhyme that's quoted in the beginning of the book, and it says, "They hang the man and flog the woman who steal the goose from off the common, but the other man they let go loose who steal the common from the goose." Prior to the event, I figured they weren't covering their fanny quite so well, and we could find out more with September 11th. And I began to clip backwards to the beginning of the year, and of course, the first indicator to me was even before that, in November of 2000, when we had this break in the script that showed us what elections are worth in the United States. And this, when I say the script, I mean two candidates of two parties are put up, no third-party candidate is allowed, a phony debate on phony issues is put forward to make us think we've got a choice between the two. If that's too deadening, then we'll be told that there's a horse race and that they're nose-to-nose in order to make it a little more interesting, as we were this time. But I would suggest that the outcome is already known in advance, and that they have never used the vote, that they couldn't afford to allow an election of that important to come down to a vote. That if they'll spend $10 million making sure who's elected in Chile, what the hell do you think they spend here, where it counts? And so the script is, you run the election, but it's really an ascendancy of a segment of the class. It's not a popular will. They don't go and count the absentee ballots and make sure who votes and get votes from overseas. They have a poll. And why you would have a poll in a democracy prior to the outcome of election, other than to influence the outcome of the election, I don't know. But the poll tells you who's going to win. And then you hear people say, well, I don't want to waste my vote on a loser. And they vote for the person they're told is going to win. So, I mean, it can be they get a landslide that way by sort of, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy. But they don't need the landslide because they've already decided the shift is there. And then they don't even finish the polling. They have the national media count the exit polls, and before people finish voting, they announce who the winner is going to be. And then the other guy gets up and concedes. And then you have the president, and that's an election. All my life, that's an election. And then that night, Gore didn't concede. And I thought, what the hell is going on? I mean, Gore is no less of a player than Bush in these scenarios. I mean, they both have big money behind them, sometimes the same money, because if you're smart enough and rich enough, you bet every horse in the race. So why is he not conceding? And then I realized, because they want us to see. They want us to know. They want us to get the message. And it was just as blatant a message as November 22nd, 1963. I believe that 63's message is, yeah, we shot the son of a bitch. What do you want to do about it? We can kill the president. We sure as hell kill you. Sit down, shut up, and get out of the way. That's the subliminal message. And the subliminal message of this election is, we done had about enough of this here democracy shit. We done already told you who won the election. Now set your whiny Democrat ass down and shut up. Get out of the way is the message. And I think they pulled up the petticoat and let us and let the rest of the world know. And that was reverberated for me right after September 11th. First week, a guy from the White House said, this war will last into the second Bush administration. We didn't elect him the first time. I guess we don't have to bother for the second time. Okay, but it was an open electoral coup. And he was in trouble. There was a global economic slump going on. The surplus was eroding in terms of the tax stuff. We were going back into a deficit situation. In June and July of last year, according to Times of India and the international press, Colin Powell visited Pakistan, India, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, the surrounding countries. This is June and July. And he told the heads of those countries and the people in the government that the United States was going to militarily intervene in mid-October to remove the Taliban. This is in June and July. This war in Afghanistan is not a response to 9/11. This is a war that, as all wars are, planned in advance. And it has to do with the fact that in 1999, a representative on foreign relations from the company called Unocal went to the Congress and told them that 80% of the world oil reserve would be in the Caspian Sea region 20 years from now. 80% of the remaining oil would be there, and that we had to get a pipeline down out of that region through Afghanistan into the sea, and that the Taliban had balked on taking the deal on that pipeline, and therefore the Taliban were in the way of our access to 80% of the world oil in the next few years, and they had to be removed. And that message was out. Now, it's interesting to me that Unocal said at that point they stopped their plans. A different company came in and started to make an alternate route across northern Afghanistan through Pakistan down to the sea. That company is called Enron. And Unocal is now back in the seat because Mr. Karzai was a consultant to Unocal, the head of Afghanistan, and the current ambassador of the United States from Afghanistan was an employee of Unocal. And the remaining five moderate leaders in Northern Alliance moderates, these guys were named in the New York Times 5 years ago as the largest opium dealers. So the oil is almost back in place. The heroin is already back in place. But what I'm telling you is that we were already going into Afghanistan with this plan before they hit any of these bumps. And then by late August, Bush clearly was getting into more trouble. His polls had gone down for popularity. He was having trouble getting elements of his domestic agenda through Congress. He was getting a lot of opposition from Daschle and Leahy and Feingold and some of the leading Democrats. The economy clearly was starting to fall. The tax deficit was rising because of his policies, and people were asking a lot of questions. And then there was a guy by the name of Kozak who had been in the State Department and was involved in the U.S. Ambassador role and in the State Department in Nicaragua, who had been an engineer of the Contra war there and part of the Contragate operation. And he, currently in the State Department, back then, was over in Belarus or White Russia, conducting an operation of the same scale, they said in the papers, in order to influence a pending election in Belarus that might have taken out a pro-socialist government and put in a more reactionary government. And all that area, Belarus, I mean, that was where the major oil fields of the Soviet Union were located. And there's tremendous riches in that sector of the world, which is why there's such a focus now on getting at them. And Brzezinski, if you go back and check his writings in the late 1980s, he says, once the Soviet Union falls, we've got to control that area up there. All the resources, all that cheap, trained labor is up there. And to get at it, we need to put military bases in Uzbekistan. And we just tripled the amount of aid to Uzbekistan, of course, again, with mostly military aid, and we're creating bases there. And I don't know if you read here in the local papers in the Bay Guardian, the way we create a base now is we hire Halliburton to take the base in a box with civilian personnel and guns, and they dump the base down and build the infrastructure, and the civilians guard it, and then the military comes into it. So that's one of the ways. I mean, and Halliburton bought out Brown and Root, which made $4 billion off of the construction they did in the Vietnam War. It was George Brown that financed LBJ into office. And then in turn, when LBJ reversed JFK's policy of withdrawal from Vietnam and went into the war, his political financiers made tremendous profits. And Cynthia McKinney, much to her chagrin and the loss of her election with the money that came out to defeat her, mentioned that, you know, perhaps it was worth questioning whether Bush and the people around him, most of which relate to the oil industry and munitions industry, might be making some profit off of the wars that they were taking us into and the kind of policies that they were taking us into. But that's not a legitimate question, apparently, for anybody in Congress to ask at this point. But here's this guy that relates back to the Contragate operation, running an operation in Belarus in early September. September the 5th, it was announced that the CIA will get its own primetime TV show, like the old FBI show. On that same day, September the 5th, it was in the papers that the United States was staging the largest joint military operation in history off of Egypt. So they're having this operation and this exercise, which moves most of the American troops right to the region where they're going to want to be when they go in October. And they're sailing around there, connected with Egypt. Then on the 4th and the 5th, there were articles in the London Sunday Times and the New York Times. And they had to do with two operations, one called Clear Vision and the other called Operation Jefferson. I don't know if you've heard of either of these. These were being conducted out at White Sands Proving Grounds and also with some military contractors. They were both CIA and DIA-related operations. Clear Vision was to do two things. It was try to create a lab with things that you could order through the internet and samples that you could order through commercial or sources to create anthrax. In other words, to grow cultures of anthrax in a laboratory that you could get to see if the terrorists could do it. The other operation was to see if terrorists could create and smuggle an anthrax bomb into the United States. And so they actually created a bomb, although they said later it didn't have a detonator and it didn't have any anthrax, that they brought this bomb and smuggled it in as a test to see whether terrorists could do this. Now, these things coming out caused an international flap because technically they're not supposed to be testing weapons or even potential weapons relating to chemical biological warfare. It's against treaties that they've signed. And so these secret operations were exposed on September the 4th and the 5th. But the more important one, Operation Jefferson, came from Rumsfeld himself. When he came into office, he ordered the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon to create the next generation of anthrax, to create an anthrax that would be genetically modified, be more lethal, be more resistant to the antibiotics, and be more distributable through its weaponization. And this is a direct violation of those treaties, to create a new weapon and a new kind of anthrax that would be harder to stop. And yet, they went ahead with these plans, and on September the 6th, the Defense Intelligence Agency had a press conference in D.C. where they announced that they not only had created but were ready to test a new generation of anthrax. That's on September the 6th. And this was all in the public press. And it was causing some flap, but generally the press just go and stick the microphone up there and they don't ask questions. On September the 8th, Ike Shelton, who's in the Congress and on some of the oversight committees in the military, put out a statement saying that they should start now to move U.S. troops to be near the section around the Caspian Sea because that would be the next hot spot for U.S. foreign policy. He didn't specifically mention Uzbekistan, but he mentioned that area there. And when we think about oil, I just give you one thing to think about. Our main concern is not that we get the oil. It's that Japan and Germany don't get the oil. Because part of the way that Japan and Germany were defeated in World War II was they have no internal oil source. And so you keep them from getting oil. And the way you do it is to make sure, first, that they don't get a pipeline anywhere to cheap oil or have access to cheap oil. And the second is that you get the pipeline, you put the oil in a tanker to sea. When the tanker goes out at sea, ports bid for it. The highest port gets it. That artificially increases the price of the oil and brings it into a situation where you've got artificially expensive oil that they can only get at a much higher price, while you, taking it from the pipeline directly, can get it more cheaply. The second thing to remember about oil, and most people don't know this, is that the trade magazines in the mid-1980s noticed that 65% of that massive amount of oil use that we already have, and they projected that 80% of the oil use by the year 2000 would be, and already was, military. I mean, this effectively means that we're fighting wars to have enough oil to fight wars. And then, again, just before September 11th, the San Francisco Chronicle reported afterwards, the mayor in San Francisco, Willie Brown, was warned not to take any commercial flights on September 11th by his securities. It was reported later that George Shultz was warned against a commercial flight. It was reported a month earlier that both Rumsfeld and Cheney had announced that they were not going to take any commercial flights. And I should say that the standing joke in D.C. is that if Cheney should have a heart attack, Bush could become president. I mean, I hope you're noticing that when we're on orange alert for a terrorist attack, Bush is left in the White House and Cheney is put down in the bunker. And maybe you heard when Cheney came out here to the Commerce Club a few weeks ago that he mentioned that the black box is with him. That's the nuclear command box. It's not supposed to be with the vice president. It's supposed to be with the president. But he said it's with him. And so the positioning of that box and that control is important. And that plane went into the Pentagon, and one of the planes went into the towers in a way that defies the ability of someone trained at a puddle jumper school on a simulator. In fact, the instructors at that school said if you tried doing those things on the plane on the simulator, it would have shut down because the plane would have been out of control. That was dogfight maneuvers with a huge commercial jet. I mean, you're going 550, 600 miles an hour, and you're banking to correct at the last minute to slam into this building. And even more amazing, the Pentagon situation, you're coming down from 7,000 feet at hundreds of miles an hour, making a 270-degree loop around the Pentagon, and then flying so low you're knocking off the lampposts in order to slam into the distant side of the building. Now, all five sides of the Pentagon are open. You don't have to go around to get to a side to hit. If you're on a military mission, aren't you going to go to the closest side? After all, you don't know that they won't use a surface-to-air missile. Why did they go all the way around to the only side of the Pentagon that is empty? 64 dead on the ground, 124 dead in the plane, 12 to 15 Pentagon employee dead. It had been under construction for 3 years. They went all the way around and hit the only side that didn't have anybody in it. Why did they go to the Twin Towers at 8:43 instead of 9:43? Why did that operation minimize the number of deaths? Hard to say when you have 2,000 dead, but 9:43 means tens of thousands dead. Most people aren't at work at 8:43. 1,500 people were taken out of the building from the 55th floor. This was a very sophisticated covert operation. Whoever flew those planes, and it's not remote control, knew what the hell they were doing in a plane. We were never given the evidence. We were told the evidence was too secret. Only the British could see it. When the British saw it, they said it won't stand up in court, but it's good enough to go to war. We still haven't seen the evidence. We were given 18 names and identities, and five people came forward in Saudi Arabia and Egypt about a month later, and they said, that's my picture, that's my name, that's my ID, I'm alive, I was never in America inside that plane. So we already got five that we don't know who they are. We got 18 that were supposed to be the hijackers, who are all Saudi Arabians, so we went and bombed Afghanistan. We're told that they're all part of the Al-Qaeda and that they're run by the evil mastermind Dr. Osama bin Laden down in his cave that only James Bond, I guess, can get. What does it tell you that bin Laden did it, if in fact bin Laden did it? Bin Laden works for Saudi intelligence. Bin Laden works for Pakistani intelligence. Bin Laden works for U.S. intelligence. Bin Laden's in Chechnya. He's in Kosovo. He's in Paris. How many masters does he have? He's like Abu Nidal. Fight every side of the thing that's going on, and he's supposedly outside of our control. The common thesis now is this is blowback, unintended consequences from an intelligence operation. But there were people tight with U.S. intelligence passing money to Muhammad Atta through Pakistani intelligence, through the same guy that funded bin Laden and the Mujahideen right up to the time of this operation. And then I'll give you the final piece of information from a Sarasota paper. Atta is living in Sarasota when he gets the money. Do you know who he's living with? One of the Iran-Contra pilots. Now I got a recent clipping that just came out within the last week that tells us that two of the other hijackers were, lo and behold, living with an FBI informant in the same apartment. I guess he wasn't a very good informant. Or maybe he was like the informant in 1993 who told the FBI that they were going to bomb the Trade Center, and the FBI said, don't get in the way. Maybe it was like the FBI who wouldn't allow the investigation of bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda and led to the resignation of John O'Neill, who was the FBI counterterrorism expert, who then got a job guarding the Twin Towers and died in the Twin Towers that day. On September the 11th, I was awakened about 8:45 after the first tower was hit by a fellow researcher who is also on, sits on the community board about matters relating to Dulles Airport. And he was already tremendously concerned. He knows about planes. He said there's no way that a commercial flight should have been anywhere near that building. I mean, this is not just a little bit off course. And when planes do go a little bit off course, they're moved out of that and taken back, or things come to intercept them under normal procedures. But he knew there was no way a plane should have been in that airspace. And so it was already, to him, more than suspicious that something was really wrong in the situation. And as we talked, by 9:03, the second plane hit. And then I remember him saying to me, the balloon is up. The balloon is up. Because he and I believe the rest of the country knew that by 9:05, accident theory and coincidence theory, as I like to call it, were out the window. And most of the rest of the country did. I live in Washington, D.C., and it is the most restricted airspace in the United States. They force commercial pilots to take what they consider a dangerous turn to land or take off from Washington, D.C., and they complain about it to this day to keep them from flying into that airspace. So something's off course or it's coming in, and I've seen them, small commercial private planes or commercial aircraft off course near D.C., things go up. On a normal day, I'm not talking about 9/11, things go up, and they wag them and they push them back out of that airspace, and they don't let them into that zone if they're not authorized to be there. And that not just in Washington, D.C., but all over the country. There are standard procedures. The FAA and the NORAD and the Pentagon have procedures for any plane that veers off course for several miles, that turns off its transponder, that fails to communicate with tower, or that does combinations of those three. Why? Because the pilot could be dead. There could be some confusion. You're endangering other plane routes. There's numerous reasons why you would go up and intercept. And this is all normal procedure. I mean, you're on the ground and you get these orders and they come through FAA and NORAD's told. So by 8:25, NORAD knows four planes have been hijacked, almost unprecedented. There's one other incident about 20 years ago. And even if you don't have advance warnings, it seems to me that even then, something should have gone up to meet them. Not only that, but the plane that turned around in Ohio and the plane that turned around in Pennsylvania after the towers were hit, after 9:05, were said by the local news, Channel 8, to be headed toward Washington, D.C. Especially Flight 77 was specifically said to be coming to D.C. Now, that's on my local news. If I knew it was coming to D.C., didn't they know it was coming to D.C.? All right, so everybody knew that it was coming to D.C., and everybody knew it wasn't off course or an accident, that it was an attack plane. And they knew it from 9:05. They have the buildings, and shortly after that, this plane turns around, and they have 35 to 40 minutes to respond to do something about a plane. They don't have to wait till it gets to P-56. You can go get it in Ohio. And they have planes. They have planes that fly 1,800 miles an hour that are ready to scramble at airports. But we just sat in Washington, D.C., and we watched it come. We not only knew it was coming, they started to evacuate the buildings. They called an evacuation of the White House. They called an evacuation at the Capitol, and they called an evacuation of the Pentagon. So they're watching it come. And I know they said afterwards that it was a total surprise and that they didn't have any mechanism to defend themselves from such a thing. They don't have any mechanism? Where did they do with your $13 trillion? I mean, isn't there a subliminal message somewhere in this great protection racket we've been paying for since the end of World War II that they can't even defend their own building? So how are they going to defend you? And, of course, they do have mechanisms. How do I know? I sat on one. When I was 10 years old, I was out eating lunch with my parents in the central courtyard of the Pentagon, and I sat on a metal box, and my dad said, "Get the hell off of that." I said, "What is it, Dad?" He said, "It's a surface-to-air missile port." You know, not a good thing to sit on. This is the 1950s. I'm not talking about last year. This is the 1950s. They had a mechanism that they could shoot a missile up from the center of the Pentagon to defend itself. We have military bases around D.C. Did you know that? We have a base called Andrews. We have an Anacostal Naval Air Station. They have the National Guard. They have Air Force planes, F-16 and F-18 fighters. A lot of times they're on scramble ready alert. Even if they aren't on scramble ready alert, you can get them up. Scramble ready, you can get them up in 3 to 6 minutes. Otherwise, you might be able to get them in 10 minutes at least. If you can't get a plane off the ground in 40 minutes, you don't have a defense anyway. Do anything go up? Mm-mm. Nothing goes up. Nothing is used. Pomona, New Jersey, there's a base, 177th Air Wing, halfway between D.C. and New York, and get to either one pretty fast. We've talked to pilots there 2 weeks before they were told to go off of alert, stand down, and take the weapons off the planes. But that day, there were two guys on the runway who took off on regular military exercise that they do where they run up to New York, load weapons, and come back down to the base going over selected target sites and doing target practice simulations. So they went up in the air between the first and second tower hits. They were on the way to New York. And for the first time, they told us, in their military career, they were told to report back to base on an emergency. They thought, not being told what it was, that one of their family members had died. They never got to New York to intercept any plane. I'm not a congressional investigator. I just ask questions. I work with a small group of independent researchers. We look around and we see what's out there. And this is what's out there when you ask down at the level that they'll never get to. They'll ask the general what happened that day. They're not going to ask the pilot. But the pilot will tell you. And the guys that worked on the ground crew will tell you. And you can figure it out. Then I tried to explain this thesis that nothing went up and why in the stand down that day to a guy at a party I met who was a correspondent at the Pentagon. And looking for a benign explanation, he said to me, yes, but didn't you read in the New York Times, and I've never been able to find the article, it must be sourced somewhere else. He said, didn't you read in the New York Times that half the planes in the United States were taken offline 3 days before the incident? I said, are you making your argument or mine? Half the planes in the United States were taken off on September the 9th or 8th? Why? Why did we suddenly take them off? Did they have no idea that planes could be used as attack weapons? Well, this paper today tells you, of course, they knew. Not only did they know, they anticipated it. Not only did they know that planes could be used that way, they knew that they had been used by that particular group in the past that way, that they had foiled an attempt to take a plane into the Eiffel Tower, that they had actually gotten a plane into a building in Moscow during the operations around Chechnya. Okay, and the planes could be used as weapons. When they took Bush to the summit in Genoa, in the economic summit, they made special provisions that no planes could fly over the area where the summit was meeting, and they moved Bush to special locations so no plane could find him and fly into the building. They know that planes can be flown into buildings and used as weapons. 1997, I went to the Pentagon with a march called A Day Without the Pentagon. I organized the march along with some other people from War Resisters League. It was the first big march to the Pentagon in 20 years. I had to meet with 20 different security agencies because D.C. is such a hodgepodge of police agencies. And I had a special meeting with the director of security of the Pentagon, a black colonel who'd been there for 30 years. He took me into places my mother never took me. He took me into the offices of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the hallway and past the place where they eat lunch, and he's pointing these things out to me. He walked me out onto the parade ground beyond it where we were going to meet and end up the march. And he said, you can't come beyond this line at the edge of the parade ground. And I said, but there's a Supreme Court decision in the 1970s that says we can come up here to the steps. He says, you can't come to the steps. We're on Delta alert. I said, what's that? That's our highest security alert. This is 1997. I said, why are you on Delta alert? He said, we get bomb threats every day from the Muslims, and we're on Delta alert. And then he pointed up to the top of the Pentagon, and he said, and we have radar up there to make sure a plane doesn't fly into the building. 97. He said, we've got cameras up there watching the skies, and we're going to be videotaping your demonstration. I said, good. Can we get a copy? He hadn't seen it yet. Did they go back to sleep? Did they turn the radar off? What happened on September 11th? You don't have to ask, what did Bush know and when did he know it? I mean, for Christ's sake, isn't the question, when was Bush told and how soon did he forget it? Here's another clip. This is about the great mayor, Rudolph Giuliani. He's attending on Friday, September the 6th, this year, a Homeland Security event in Chicago and at this institute that deals with security and law enforcement. And along with Mr. Giuliani, they're going to have an appearance by John Fulton of the Central Intelligence Agency, who will discuss intelligence gathering and analysis for the future of Homeland Security. And it says here that John Fulton has extensive experience in the intelligence community. And on the morning of September the 11th, 2001, he and his team were running a pre-planned simulation to respond to the emergency that might be created and the issues that would be created if a plane were to strike a building. Then we have an AP report on the incident by John Lumpkin, dated Wednesday, August 21st. In what the government describes as a bizarre coincidence, one U.S. intelligence agency was planning an exercise September 11th in the morning when an errant aircraft would crash into one of its buildings, but the cause wasn't terrorism, it was a simulated accident. What building? Chantilly, Virginia-based National Reconnaissance Office. The NRO, the spy satellites, the DIA, is going to simulate an attack. Adding to the coincidence, 4 miles away, American Flight 77, the Boeing 767 hijacked and crashed into the Pentagon, took off from Dulles at 8:10 a.m. More coincidence. The NRO operates many of the nation's spy satellites, and it draws its personnel from the military and the CIA. I believe there was a military stand-down on 9/11, and I think that that's their Achilles heel. I don't think they can argue that they didn't know anything was happening after the second tower, or that they didn't have a response. And it's the thing they're most vulnerable on, and they haven't given us a reasonable explanation so far, and I don't think they have one. And that's what I think we should go after. In addition, D.C. went into military and emergency response. There was a declaration of national emergency, and running the country at that point are the DOD, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the National Security Agency and Council. When the people at National Airport, what they like to call Reagan Airport, people at D.C. National Airport wanted to get back in business after a month and were losing money every day, they were told, that's not a local decision anymore. You have to take that up with the National Security Council. Continuity government means, which they put into effect that day, it means that a much smaller number of people actually make the government decisions. Then there was a headline in the Washington Post, Shadow Government Operating in Secret. Banner headline. I said, my God, I can get a job there finally. Shadow Government Operating in Secret, and it said that Cheney and the middle management people of the government were all down in a bunker. Didn't get a disclosed location. It's Bluemont, Virginia. You know, it's down in this hole that my mother used to call the Little Pentagon. And then he communicates back to Camp David on a big screen like Big Brother. This big Cheney comes into Bush. And Bush is up in the White House with the Congress. Now, which one do you think the shadow government is? And that day, it looked to me, and all the projections were that I had seen from the government, that they might go to martial law. They not only stopped the planes, they stopped the trains. They stopped the metro. They turned certain streets in D.C. into one way. They closed down a section of 395 in the interstate highway system. And interstate highways are one of the things that go under military control when you go into these emergency situations. Then I looked on the local TV and I saw park police with Uzi machine guns. These guys with little hats that take you around the monuments were out there with their Uzis. And then they said, it's time for the government employees to go home. Well, I know D.C. When you get the government employees out, they could care less about the people that live in D.C., okay? Most are black and Hispanic, poor people. So I figured they're going to clamp down. I don't know if the scenario is finished. I live near the Maryland border. I took my two hard disks and some books and some clothes, and I got in my car and went out into Maryland to at least see what the hell the next step was going to be. And I waited and snuck back in at 2:30 or 3 o'clock. It didn't seem to be a perimeter border, but I had no indication that they wouldn't do that, that all the indications were that they were going in that direction. And I would suggest to you, with Cheney in charge of the black box at this late point, that we are still in continuity of government since 9/11. D.C., if you come to it, you will see how militarized it remains and the presence of the military all over. They don't even talk to the cops. They just come out and close off sections of the streets whenever they want to. And the D.C. police are ignored. It's a colony anyway. And we've never had real local rule in D.C. Our license plates say taxation without representation. We did that so Bush had to put one on his car. But let me get to one more thing at least, which is anthrax. That's almost as good a story, if not better. We have anthrax attacks, just as everybody's starting to come down from 9/11, and we have anthrax attacks. Do the terrorists go after Bush? Do they go after Rumsfeld? Do they go after Cheney? Do they go after the Republican leadership in the Congress who's carrying on the war against Afghanistan? No. Where do they send them? The first place to get an anthrax envelope, as you may remember, is the tabloid headquarters in Florida. When I first read that, I thought, well, you know, the tabloids are a CIA propaganda tool anyway. I figured this is a false story, but the guy actually dies. He's a photo editor. But it's just another coincidence. He's a photo editor at the tabloids who happened to be the photo editor that first put in pictures of Bush's daughters being arrested for drunk driving. It's just a coincidence. Okay. Then where do they go? They go to Rather and Brokaw up at NBC and the national news networks. That's who they scare next. And I'm no friend of them. I know Rather was part of the lies in the Kennedy assassination. But relative to the current scope of discussion, these are liberals in the media. Okay, because the discussion has shifted so far to the right that it's a debate between an open fascist and a moderate conservative, which means that a liberal is what a commie was in the 50s, and it means I'm so far over there to the left, I'm a terrorist. All right, and the rest of us probably in the room. You know, you look like terrorists to me anyway. We are outside the government, and we have less power. We are only able to wage asymmetrical warfare, and we're fighting for justice. However we fight, we're terrorists, even if we don't use weapons within that framework. So, and then the main opponents of the Bush domestic agenda get envelopes, Daschle and Leahy, and a spillover to Feingold. And also the main opponents up till that day of the U.S. Patriot Act, who were questioning the U.S. Patriot Act up until they got the anthrax envelopes. And what's in the envelopes? An anthrax that's so sophisticated, they said it couldn't have been developed in the Soviet Union or the United States. They said, what's left? Outer space? Who else is left to develop something? But, you know, let's not admit it could come from here. It hasn't got any aluminum tracing because it's not from Iraq. We do the chemical tests on it, and then we do a DNA test on it, and lo and behold, it's AIM strain anthrax. That means it's U.S. anthrax. It means it comes from the most common place that anthrax comes from in the United States, University of Iowa at Ames, who maintained an archive of every known strain of anthrax. Anthrax is a natural disease. It's zoonotic. It passes from animals to humans. It's a farm disease. They've known about it since the 1920s. They took every strain and also tested those strains for antibiotics and other responses on those strains. And there's a whole archive kept of small samples so that they can be cultured and used. And there's a paper trail. So if you want this particular strain of anthrax from this particular batch, you send it out and there's a paper trail. Who experimented on it? Who ordered it? 10 days before the envelopes are sent, the FBI calls the University of Iowa at Ames and tells them to destroy the archive after 70 years, which means that we know it came from Ames, but we don't know from what batch. We can't tell from what batch. And without knowing from what batch, we can't tell where it went to, even though there was a paper trail before they destroyed it. The FBI called 10 days before and had the batch destroyed. That was in the New York Times. The bungling FBI. When they looked at this anthrax, they said, this is like nothing we've ever seen. There's a trillion spores per gram. It had been 1 to 2 billion spores per gram in the previously weaponized anthrax. It's also so distributable, so fluffy, which means it's got no electromagnetic bonding on these individual spores, that anything will spread it. You know, the wind will spread it. It spreads like hell. And it's more lethal. Now, what does that match? Is that the next generation of anthrax that I told you about, that it was ready to test on September the 6th? I think it is. And then they not only went to Ames, it suddenly became clear that it had been weaponized through Fort Detrick. And the investigation went to the gate of Fort Detrick, and it stopped dead. For months, we didn't hear anything about the anthrax investigation. And now what do we hear? It's one lone nut. It's, again, a lone nut that did this. Only that's falling apart. The evidence they have on this guy is not holding. I asked the question in 1996, are you scared yet? Because in Europe, from the end of World War II forward, with U.S. CIA and other intelligence-backed operations like Gladio and Propaganda Due, there were plans put in effect there and eventually brought here. But from the 40s on, there was this agent provocateur kind of situations. And they carried on these operations, and now we know from documents related to, in Bamford's new book, Body of Secrets, that Operation Northwoods and General Lemnitzer, who was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on November 22nd, 63, had plans to create terrorist incidents or simulated terrorist incidents in the United States that could be blamed on Castro and Cuba as an excuse to go to war with Cuba, including crashing commercial planes full of people. This is the 1960s that the Pentagon is thinking about, actively thinking about, and carrying through these things. And, of course, the cost of all this is civil liberties and the establishment of permanent war, a permanent war economy. We were told that we were going into a 10-year war the first week after September the 11th. Now, that resonated to me because my mother projected the draft call figures 5 years in advance. She had to project them accurately enough within 100 people either way in the annual national call that went up to 50,000 people. She had tables. How many will retire? How many will reenlist? How many will enlist anew? How many will discharge under each category? And if there was going to be a war, she had attrition levels that she was given. How many will die? How many will be wounded? How many will discharge from medical conditions? How many do we have now? How many do we want down the pike? How many do we have to draft each year to get there? Then they would take those figures that my mother came up with, accurate enough within 100 people either way that far ahead, and they would multiply them by 5. And they would give that to the draft boards as their quota. Why? Because 50 to 55% will flunk a physical, 10 to 15% will get a deferment or exemption from the draft, and 10 to 15% will no-show and resist, and we're back down to the 20% we want in the first place. This is planning, folks. So I asked my mother. She retired in 1973. She was not happy with the war in Vietnam. When she finally retired, she'd been a pacifist between the wars, but thought you had to fight Hitler, and then thought you had to fight communism, the same as Hitler. But Vietnam and the level of civilian deaths and the weapons freaked her out, as they should have. Civilian death in World War I is 4%. Non-combat-related World War II deaths, 25%. Korea, 54%. Vietnam, 94%. That means in modern warfare, collateral damage is the combat troop. Get it straight when you're talking about going to war. It's not soldiers that are going to be dying in the large amount. It's civilians. It's families and it's civilians because of the nature of the war and the nature of the weapons. So I asked her, when did they tell you that they would escalate the war in Vietnam? Because she had to be among the first to know. She said that in April of 1963, for the first time in her career, she was given orders to change her projections. They were from the White House. They were orders from John F. Kennedy. They were orders to change the projections in Southeast Asia, specifically in Vietnam, for a full withdrawal of American troops by the end of 1964. A full withdrawal by the end of 1964. I said, when did they turn around? When did they tell you they would escalate in Vietnam? She said, late November. I said, the last week in November, Kennedy's killed on the 22nd. She said, the Monday following the assassination. Kennedy barely in the grave. I said, was this just a few more advisors? She said, I couldn't believe the figures. I took them back to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I said, these can't be right. And I used to tease my mother afterwards that that was the first civilian protest to the war in Vietnam. November 25, 1963, they told my mother they were going into a 10-year war in Vietnam with 57,000 American dead. That's where they went. That's how long it took them. So when they told me September 11th, we're going into a 10-year war, I know that they plan wars that way. Then after that, we were told by Rumsfeld that it was a war that may not end in our lifetime. Just in the last week and a half, we've been told that it's a 60-year war. This is a world war. There's no other name for this. This is a war that almost, through its destabilization of situations in Afghanistan, led to a nuclear war in Pakistan and India. We're in a world that's too interconnected to go playing these games. Things fall apart. If we erode the international balance, everyone else will erode the international balance. This is a world war. And it's up to the American people to stop this madness. There's no one else left in the world with the power that the American people have to bring this machinery to a halt. There's no other country that has the capability to stop this genocidal machine. What's been done that led to the events of 9/11, with or without U.S. complicity, has been done in our name for the last 50 years, and we're suffering the consequences. We're going to live the consequences of whatever's decided now. Should it be decided in secret behind a closed door by Mr. Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush, or is it a decision that belongs to the American people? This is a decision that belongs to a real democracy. And it has to be. There was a paradigm shift that day. Another quote from Rumsfeld, "This war will secure American interests abroad for decades to come." Charles Krauthammer the other day, the reactionary neocon columnist in the Washington Post, pressed by others on an NBC talk show to give a valid reason to go to Iraq, finally blurted out, "There will be a tremendous financial windfall for the United States when we seize their oil." It's about resources. It's about what Buckminster Fuller called in the last book, Grunch, gross universal cash heist. It's about an alignment of a real axis of evil on September the 11th, and after that, an alignment of the United States, Europe, and the globalized corporations and their control through the World Bank and the IMF of the neoliberal model countries that they are corrupting, and taking over the resources and the labor of and the wannabes. Russia is the first country to call Bush with an offer to help. China jumped into the World Trade Organization September the 12th. That's what's aligned against what? The underdeveloped countries and the pockets of resistance that remain in the neoliberal countries and us. That's why we're terrorists, because we don't fit the model. I mean, we can be good Germans, perhaps, and a few of us can go along, but only a few of us, because there's not that much to go around when you concentrate wealth at this tremendous level. We're going into permanent war economy, deficit, economic slump, an end to social security and social services, increased secrecy, a curbing of civil rights. I believe that we are at a crossroad in human history. I agree with Leonard Cohen in the song The Future that love is the only engine of human survival. I think that to pick up a weapon in the 21st century means that you lack imagination. You can't beat them at that gun game, that violence game. It doesn't go anywhere. If you don't know how to use your head and your heart to win, you'll lose. This is what Dr. King was talking about. And we need to decentralize power. We need to give people back their power, because not only are they separated from their history and don't know where they are, but they also are taught that they have no power. They're taught that it's impossible to do anything. But in fact, there's much that we can do. Rights are inalienable. They are conceptual. They are on paper. And even when they take them away on paper, they don't take them away up here. Even when they destroy the word in the dictionary, they can't really destroy the concept. And if we use our rights, they become our rights. So if they want to make it more secret, we should try to make it more open. If they say you don't have a right, we should use the right. We are now faced, said Dr. King, with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfinished conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing here naked and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain in the flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is deaf to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late. There is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. This may well be mankind's last chance to choose between chaos and community.
You have been listening to conspiracy researcher John Judge speaking on 9/11 and new wars. For more writings by John Judge, visit the website www.radical.org. That's www.radical.org. This is the Radio Internet Story Exchange. Please visit the RISE website at www.riseforNews.net. That's RISE, the number 4, news.net. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris. Thanks for listening.